This is Inside Douglas County on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN. Every weekday, we talk with public officials, business and education leaders, nonprofit organizations, and more about the issues of the day. As we work hard to help you stay connected with local news and information, presented by Roseburg Foot and Ankle Specialists. Now, here's Inside Douglas County on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
It is officially summer, of course, and now I want to get another update on summer ag in Douglas County. Logan Bennett from the Oregon State University Extension Service. He joins us pretty much every month to take a look at what's going on. Thanks for coming in.
Absolutely. Glad to be here.
So let's see here. This time of year, and maybe not the last few days so much, but what we were dealing with several days ago probably brings irrigation to the forefront.
Yeah. And I know that's been a frequent topic for us, but this is when we normally talk about irrigation on top of just the drought. But irrigation is not only super important because we're looking at a drought year, but also because it can be one of the most expensive production costs on a farm.
And I don't think maybe people think about that. If you have, like I do, a house with your typical lot, I've got a sprinkler system, I can decide, you know, just how green I want to keep it, knowing what the bill may result in. Well, that's a 70 by 100 foot lot.
Right.
And sometimes the bill is a little high because I do like it to look nice. Let's take 10 acres. Let's take 100 acres. Let's talk irrigation about that. It's different because it's not coming from a city, but still, I imagine the cost could be pretty high.
It certainly can, and especially if you're paying for water, too, not only just irrigating like out of a water right, but even if you are irrigating out of a water right, maintaining your pumps, making sure that your system's working well, and keeping everything clean can be expensive, too.
And for some people, I suppose, as well, you're going to have time into, depending on how you're set up, moving that irrigation equipment around.
Oh, for sure. So if you're using standard hand line, which for somebody who doesn't know what hand line is, those are those large aluminum pipes that you often put sprinklers on the top of, that takes a long time to move those around. And they're kind of limited or can be limited in how you set them up. But it doesn't matter if you're using hand line, K-line, or even a big irrigation pivot. All of that takes time.
And it would be cost prohibitive if you've got a number of acres, probably, to have all of it with that equipment sitting there the whole time.
Oh, yeah, that can get expensive really quick.
Right. So that's a definite issue. What about organic matter in the soil this time of year?
So organic matter is one of those things that we want to use to help us reduce irrigation over time. So when we're talking about irrigation, there's two things that I see frequently. We're either irrigating too much or irrigating too little. When we irrigate too much, not only is it expensive, but we're increasing our chances of diseases like root rots and pests like spotted wing Drosophila if you're growing fruit. If we wait to irrigate till we start seeing things wilt, then we've already lost crop production. And that matters whether it's a family garden or if you're producing on a 400-acre farm. So things that we can do to reduce that water usage while maintaining a healthy crop include deep watering versus frequent. So we don't want to be watering every day for 5 minutes and trying to keep it up. Instead, we should be watering deep to get deeper rooting, more drought tolerance, and a healthier soil biology. And the other thing we can do is increase that soil organic matter. So when I was in college, one of the big things was, how do we fix soil health? We add organic matter. And for the most part, that's kind of true. As an example, 1% in organic matter increase per acre can hold 20,000 gallons more water per acre.
Wow.
Yeah, so if we're working on increasing that organic matter, we are getting free water storage.
And as well, I'm going to channel Mike Winters a little bit here. And what about the time of day to water or not water?
For sure. This is an important question. When we're thinking about watering, we should not be watering in the middle of the day. We are wasting water. We're getting a lot of evapotranspiration if we're watering through the middle of the day. Evapotranspiration is a big word.
It's a big word. Wow.
But it translates to a pretty easy concept. Evaporation, water leaving the soil and the surface. Transpiration, water leaving the plant. So the hotter it is when we water, the more evapotranspiration we see. So we should be watering early in the morning or in the evening.
All right, keep that in mind. Now, what about dry farming? I hear about this sometimes from some of the wine community, but I know it applies to other crops as well.
Yeah, for sure. So dry farming is becoming one of the hottest topics around here, no pun intended. But what we think about when we think about dry farming meaning no irrigation. And that's not true. When we're dry farming, we are focusing on using winter soil moisture to carry us through the season. And we may be a pretty good place for dry farming. The vineyards would say yes, because a lot of them already dry farm. But we can look at other crops as well. So why might we work for dry farming? We have relatively wet winters, and we have relatively deep soils, which means water retention, and then our growing season is pretty long. So those are a few of those major ingredients needed to actually grow crops here.
Now, are there some that generally don't work with dry farming?
Yeah, so there's a few that do and don't work with dry farming. So if you're growing corn, lettuce, celery, most brassicas, cucumbers, some of the berries, and some of the trees at home, that's typically not a great choice for dry farming. Whereas if you're growing potatoes, winter squash, garlic, dry beans, tomatoes, believe it or not, there's some really good dry farming tomato varieties. We're growing one at the Discovery Garden called Native Sun right now. We'll see how it turns out. Some of the orchard crops like olives, hazelnuts do really well after establishment with dry farming. And then up on campus, we're actually looking at growing squash and watermelon dry farmed.
Now, so does this work commercially?
It can work commercially. One thing that we want to think about is where are you, how deep are your soils, and how much water are you storing over the winter? So especially in like a farmer's market capacity, dry farming can work. On a larger capacity, it can too, but we want to think about the reality of dry farming, which is we're going to have lower yields, but typically higher quality produce.
Now, is it something that everybody should try?
No, we want to think about dry farming as a management tool in the toolkit. So this can be a really successful way to grow, especially if you're a small farm or you're using specialty crops like those Native Sun tomatoes we talked about, or you're doing like direct to market, or if you're a vineyard. But it's kind of a big jump to directly implement dry farming on your whole farm. It can make or break if you do it all at once.
One of the things I learned after coming here is that soil isn't all the same.
Yes.
And I don't think that was something I'd really ever thought of until somebody started pointing out different areas, Roseburg or some of the rural areas, and how different the soil could be. Talk about that in terms of agriculture.
Yeah, so soil is a highly diverse thing. In the United States, we have over 20,000 individual soil types described. And even here in the county, there are hundreds of different soil types. So when we're thinking about that, you know, a lot of folks here tell me that they have, you know, the quote-unquote black mud on their ground and their property. You go outside during the summer and it's like concrete and it's all cracked open. You go outside in the winter and it's super mucky and gets stuck on your boots. That is one class of soils called verdisols, vertil or verta, meaning verdic, meaning shrink, swell. Those soils can be hard to grow a lot of produce in, but they often do well for forage, as an example. Out at the Discovery Garden, we have a soil that's called a Sutherland silt loam. It has more silt in it and more sand in it and less clay. What that means for us is it dries quicker. It goes through water quicker, percolates, and it holds just enough nutrients to make it a nice, healthy soil. So we can grow most crops and ornamental plants out there pretty well without having that issue of that shrink and swell with the clay. But even on a single property, you can have more than one soil type. It's largely variable dependent on the microclimates on your property, the elevation on your property, and what it historically has been. So for example, if you live in an old riverbed, you likely have more sandy soils, whereas if you live on the edge of that river, you may have more clayey soils.
Wow, a lot to it. We're going to talk more when we come back to interview a podcast after one at 541radio.com. Inside Douglas County, 1245 News Radio, 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN. Inside Douglas County, 1247, Lars Larson at 1. Logan Bennett from the Oregon State University Extension Service. You have a master's degree in?
Soil science.
Wow. I don't think I knew that was necessarily a thing.
I'm a professional dirt nerd.
How'd you get interested in that in terms of pursuing that as a degree?
So, great question. My original plan when I went to Oregon State University was to get a degree in natural resource management with the goal of becoming a fish and wildlife police officer. So I have a background in fish and wildlife law enforcement and forestry. But while I was there, I took an extra credit class to work on a small farm to get some credits built up for my minor, which was that fish and wildlife law enforcement. Turned out, working on a small farm was pretty fun. The more I did it, the more I liked it. And then the farmer, who is also a professor on the campus, told me that if I went to grad school, I could learn how to write grants. So I went to grad school for soil science to learn how to grow crops more efficiently. Never learned how to write grants till after I was out of grad school, but it just turned into this amazing sort of passion of mine. So soils are kind of the foundation of everything I do, and they're so interesting.
Now, what else do we need to talk about in terms of the soils?
So this is a good transition to talk about fertility. When we're looking at soils, we want to think about soil fertility in terms of growing and efficiency. So this time of year, I get the question, should I be fertilizing? What should I fertilize with? And how much fertilizer do I need? And those are all important questions, but we want to think about this sort of in the context of, do I even need to fertilize? Because we can be spending a lot of extra money and potentially harming our crops if we fertilize incorrectly. So fertilizers can be super important. We can also use them incorrectly and spend a lot of extra money. A healthy crop needs about 17 essential nutrients, kind of like we do, to grow. But we want to make sure that we're adding the right thing at the right time. So first things first, soil testing comes first. Don't guess, test when we're thinking about what we should fertilize with and when we should fertilize. We're looking at investing $30 to $50 typically in a soils test to get most of the information we need. If you're growing commercially and you've got specialty crops that require specific micronutrients, you might want to use a different test than that one. But for the most part, for most of us, something like a regular standard, quote unquote, soil test can tell you most of what you need.
And how, who does that? How do you get it done? What do you do?
Great question. So there's a lot of soil testing facilities throughout the United States. There's a few in Oregon that you can utilize. OSU has one. There's one called ANL, now called Matrix. There's Umpqua soil testing. What I would recommend you do is check out our list on the Extension website. It shows every testing facility locally, what they test for, and what you might want to get a test from them for.
Okay, and a lot of other things related to soils here I see.
Yeah, so, excuse me. One thing that's important to know with soils and fertility is that most Oregon soils contain or have adequate amounts of some of our macronutrients, the big three, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, and some of our micronutrients. So in Oregon, phosphorus is pretty commonly adequate in the soil for most things that we're growing. And then things like magnesium, molybdenum, boron are mostly already adequate in the soil. So when we're thinking about what to put on the ground, we want to make sure that we're purchasing things that don't have too much of those micros or macros. And as an example, with boron, if you over-fertilize with boron, which is very easy to do, you can damage your crops really quickly.
And that, so too much of a good thing.
Yeah. So we can kind of think of plants and fertilization as humans, right? So let's think of nutrition nutrition for athletes. A marathon runner and a power lifter aren't going to need the same amount of nutritions or the same kind of food. So we want to think about what we're putting into our bodies or the soil and how we do that.
Wow. So much other things here with soil. What about composting?
Composting can be a great way to add fertilizer without having to go buy fertilizer. One thing to think about is A, fertilizer can be quite expensive, and B, it may not always be as available as we'd like. So compost is a way to kind of make your own fertilizer as a soil amendment from the things that you have or can get for a little cost to free. So when we're thinking about compost, ideally, we're going to get a little complicated here, then we're going to work back. We're looking at a 20 to 1 or 30 to 1 carbon to nitrogen ratio. What that means is we're trying to get 30 parts carbon to 1 part nitrogen to make an ideal compost. And that's going to help us add nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, and probably more importantly, biology to our soils.
Wow. What else do you think people should know about soils?
Okay, so this is a great question. When we're thinking about soils specifically, we should be thinking about planting the right plant in the right place. Meaning, if we're trying to reduce our fertilizer costs, reduce our fight against what we're trying to grow, if we plant a plant that does well in the kind of soil that we have, we're going to have a lot more success.
Wow. And of course, that's the point of doing all this, whether you're an ag operation or just somebody with your small lot at home.
Absolutely. We want to see these things grow and succeed. So if we're thinking about fertilization, soil type, organic matter additions, and watering beforehand, we're going to have a lot more success.
How do cover crops play into this picture?
Cover crops are fantastic. So what we're doing there is, A, we're keeping living roots in the ground, so reducing erosion over time. And then B, we're also adding nutrients back into the soil or removing nutrients if that's the issue that we have. Cover crops, for those who've never planted one, we are putting a crop in the ground in the fall that is not a commercial crop and overwintering it to harvest in the spring. And what we're doing is reducing erosion, but we're also adding nutrients if we plant something like a legume that can fix nitrogen in the soil, or removing nutrients if we do something like planting a grain in a crop, or excuse me, in a soil that has too much nutrient in it already. So depending on what your primary goal is, we can really help amend that soil before we plant that following spring.
So what's the difference between mulching and composting?
Mulching is a different story. When we're talking about mulching, we're putting things on top of the soil physically to reduce water loss, to increase soil organic biology, where composting is adding organic matter directly into the soil. Now, that's not to say that mulch won't add additions to your soil over time. So, for example, if you're putting out wood chips or wood bark on the ground as a mulch, you're not directly feeding the soil right off the bat, but what you are doing is feeding the fungi in those mulches. And the fungi help us transition nutrients, help us break down that carbon source and get it added back into the soil, which will eventually add nitrogen, and it helps increase soil health overall.
A lot of interesting information about soil. Now, you've got something here that is either something I don't understand or is a misprint, possibly. But fertigation?
Fertigation, that's another big word.
Never used that on the radio.
Yeah, so fertigation and chemigation are both topics that we use, or both practices that we use in agriculture. The idea being that we are injecting fertilizer or pesticides for chemigation into the irrigation pump to more efficiently deliver those to the plants. And the reason I brought it up here is if you have the ability to fertigate, it can be an effective method to reduce the amount of fertilizer that you're adding to your field overall and still get that growth that you're after.
And you also mentioned foliar fertilizers.
Yes. So this is sort of maybe a controversial question. I don't know. Foliar fertilizers are things that we spray directly onto the plant to get increased growth. These can be a really beneficial thing, especially mid-season, to get nutrients directly into the plants. But we want to be thinking about when we're using it. So, for example, we don't want to go through and add a foliar nitrogen to blueberries, as an example, at the end of the season, because what we'll see is a really quick sprout of growth, which is the intention. But if we do that towards the fall, then we have all this new supple growth that is more likely to need more water and to get frost damage or new diseases. So they have their place.
What about homemade fertilizers?
So homemade fertilizers can be a good thing. They can also be a bad idea. So there's a lot of information online. We want to be careful about that. One of the examples I see most frequently is compost tea. That'd be a homemade fertilizer. Oftentimes people are doing that to add more nutrients and biology to their soil and plants. One thing I want to caution folks is compost is what you use. It turns out to be what you use, right? So whatever we put into the compost is what the compost comes out as. And when we're making a tea out of it, steeping it, if it's done incorrectly, it can be dangerous to put on food crops. So I like using compost on ornamental plants that I don't intend to eat.
And so what you're really trying to do here is see long-term success, not just something that's going to happen. Help you briefly, but not in the future.
Right. Building healthy soils takes time. This is a multi-year project to increase the health of your soil, but what you're going to see is an increased biology level, which means an increased plant health and an increased yield. So we want to take the approach that we're working over time to make our soils as healthy as possible.
Now, when you had this degree program in soils, how many years did that take?
That took me 2 years, but it can be a longer program than that. There's folks that are doing PhDs in soil science that are, you know, taking 4 to 6 years. And it I know it sounds silly that soil science is a degree, but you can really get focused in this, whether it's soil morphology, so looking at the descriptions and the history in soils. My degree was more focused on soil pathology and soil pest management, so I looked a lot at particularly a genus called Phytophthora, which is Latin for plant destroyer, and how to manage that species chemically and non-chemically.
Logan Bennett from the Oregon State University Extension Service. You want to come back tomorrow and finish this?
Yeah. Do you have time?
I do.
I might do that.
All right, we'll talk about that. He came in with 3 pages of notes. We've gotten to the bottom of page one.
Yeah, that happens.
So we'll continue on tomorrow on Inside Douglas County. Thanks for coming in.
Absolutely. Thank you.
1258 News Radio, 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This has been Inside Douglas County on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN. Listen every weekday afternoon at 12:30 to stay connected with what's happening in your community. It's presented by Roseburg Foot and Ankle Specialists. Today's interview will be available as a podcast in just a few minutes at 541radio.com. So share it with others. Inside Douglas County is a public affairs presentation of Brook Communications on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.